You're listening to The 11th Hour. This year is the centenary of the birth of Cork sculptor Seamus Murphy. Still remembered fondly in his native city, the centenary will be marked by a series of events running from now until September. Earlier this evening, the Everyman Palace Theatre opened its adaptation by Johnny Hanrahan of Murphy's book Stone Mad. The book is Murphy's own account of the Stonies and his apprenticeship into the trade in the Cork of the 1920s. I'm joined now in the Cork studio by playwright and director Johnny Hanrahan, who adapted the play, and also a friend of Seamus Murphy's, Professor John A. Murphy. You're both very welcome to the 11th Hour. John A. Murphy, you were born in Macroom. Seamus Murphy was born in Macroom. When did you meet him?
In the 1960s. In fact, I was introduced to him when we were both on holidays in Ballyferriter. And the man who introduced us was a well-known Irish language enthusiast, a Cork priest, another Murphy on Tahar Taigo Maracu. Sean Reardon said about him that his real vocation was introducing people to one another. Thereafter, I came to know Seamus in the atmosphere of the Palace Bar, a renowned watering place, where on Friday nights and sometimes on other nights we would foregather, maybe a group of 8-10 people. We became very close and the conversation was marvellous. And it was there, I suppose, I began to know him quite well, himself and his great friend Sean Hendrick, to whom Stone Mad is dedicated. Hendrick and Murphy stood for a kind of intellectual integrity in Cork. Sean O'Fallon and Frank O'Connor, they're great friends. Jackie Hendrick is mentioned quite a lot in both of their memoirs. They were the fellows who got away, escaped from what they saw as Cork's provincialism. But Seamus and Sean stayed and really flourished and helped to make it a city that was far from provincial, really, in its interests.
But of course he wrote that very famous book, Stone Mad, back in the 50s. That book was kind of like a tribute to the dying trade of the stonemasons. But did it have literary merit too?
Yes, it did. I mean, much of the description there, as Johnny Hanrahan knows too well, a lot of the book is taken up with the actual technical description of the craft, using words that are now archaic, I suppose, since the craft has died, as it were, for the most part. The words have died with them. But the writing is splendid, and the character differentiation is very acute, and he manages to create these characters afresh, as it were, and different from each other. But it seems to me that there's a lot of himself talking as well. You know, the book was published in 1966, and Seamus was then about nearly 60 years of age, and he was recalling a period which was well before that, perhaps 30 years before. And therefore, you know, you can't take the thing literally when he attributes verbatim statements to the various characters. He is surely, if you like, recreating it in an artistic sense. But a lot of his own reflections and beliefs come out in it as well, I think. Perhaps a kind of anti-clericalism, which was partly inherited, but partly the product of resentment at, if you like, the Philistine nature of the church and the fact that he himself singularly failed to be recognised and distinguished by the church, when there was a fair amount of patronage to be dished out in the building of new churches here in Cork. So there's a lot of himself in it as well, but Johnny Hanrahan would know a lot about it.
Well, go on, Johnny, you tell us what attracted you to the book Stone Mad. Why did you adapt it as a play?
Well, it was commissioned actually by Pat Talbot, artistic director of The Everyman. He asked me would I be interested in adapting it. I've done quite a bit of adaptation, and I had read it as a young man and went back to it. So I suppose I went at it in a quite a utilitarian way to start with. I just wanted to see, was it possible to create a dramatic form for this book? And it became quite clear to me quite quickly that I could, but it wasn't a simple task necessarily, in that the first quarter of the book, if you like, is about Seamus Murphy's development, and it's about his youth and indeed about his mentors. And Seamus talked very affectionately about the impact that these older men had on him, actually, and on the effect, the lifelong strong affection you feel for people who set you on your road. So to a large extent, he's quite self-revealing in the first third of the book, I suppose, in that we see him as a young man. He's gazing back on his early life and you have a sense of a very definite development. It was clear to me that that was undoubtedly going to be the first act of the play. As a book, it's a memoir, it's discursive, and it's quite meandering in places, actually. And that's part of its charm. You feel like you're on a journey down a road and you don't know what's going to be around the next corner a lot of the time. But in theatrical terms, that was a concern. And it became clear to me after a while that really what bound most of the rest of the book together, or a lot of it at any rate, was the decline of the stone trade itself.
But so, I saw a version of this done by the one-man show by Eamon Kelly. A very fine show. Do you take a different structure? You've put more characters in the play than just Seamus himself.
I did. I also came to it as an innocent in that I didn't ever see that show, and I didn't, nor did I wish to kind of, you know, if I don't know if there is a video of it, hardly, I suppose, but I didn't seek it out or anything. I thought it was better to go
It was a tremendous show, though. I worked on it myself.
And everybody says that, and I've no doubt that that was the case. And I was actually asked by Pat Talbot to look at it as an ensemble piece. So from the start, I was looking at it as a piece of work for five or six actors, you know. And I could well see how it would make a wonderful one-man show, actually, because Seamus Murphy's personality is actually quite radiant in the book, even though he is talking about other people. And as John A. says, he's recreating those people, sometimes to fit in perhaps with aspects of himself. To me, the whole book reads like a kind of an oblique or a secret autobiography, if you like. He is the overwhelming presence in that book, even if he's talking about all these other men, even if he's creating an incredibly vivid kind of dialogue for these people and an idiom, both technical and kind of personal, which is completely arresting. I mean, this was an intellectual. This was a man of very considerable intellectual refinement who wore his learning very lightly, actually.
But it was interesting, though, they're talking about John A. Murphy being intellectual. Or not John A. Murphy, Seamus Murphy. John A. Murphy is also an intellectual, by the way. But,
thank you very much. Sean
O'Fallon was saying that in Cork at the 50s was a grand place for the ordinary man, purgatory for the artist, and sheer hell for the intellectual. How did you cope with that, John A. Murphy and Seamus Murphy? How did you cope with the sheer hell for the intellectual of Cork?
Well, you know, there's a bit of pretentiousness about O'Fallon and a bit of condescension. It's just part of his personality. He was so attuned to the finer points of European civilization and so knowledgeable and so on that I think he no longer had any time for living in Cork. I think O'Connor was much more affectionate, really, and made nostalgic journeys back and so on. But to us at the time, of course, there were restrictions, obviously, in Irish life, in Irish intellectual life, and there were the more obvious matters like censorship and so on. But just as it's a mistake to think of, say, of UCC, my own university back in the 1950s, as a terribly restrictive place, even though there were rules and regulations, people make their own freedoms within the structures. And our talking shop in the Palace Bar on Friday nights, you know, created its own atmosphere. And I remember a typical kind of a clerical ecclesiastical row between Bishop Cornelius Lucy, who then dominated, if you like, the church in Cork. And he expressed disapproval of an intended showing of a Tennessee Williams, a film version of the Tennessee Williams play, rather akin to the Rose Tattoo row in Dublin. And Sean Hendrick stood out there, you know, and challenged the bishop publicly. That's what I meant a while ago when I said about their flinty intellectual integrity. There was that kind of determination there and courage. And that made for its own kind of intellectual excitement. So you wouldn't want to exaggerate the kind of restrictive atmosphere.
But Sean Hendrick said that at one time, the trouble with this country is we never found out that we won. There was a certain disappointment about how the new state turned out for people like Sean Hendrick, wasn't there?
Well, that's very interesting. He turned his back on this. He felt the state was a disappointment to those who had struggled, as it were, for the Republic. But he never deserted the nation, if I may make the distinction. Sean Hendrick, in his old age, maybe the year before he died, and a not well man, campaigned in public against Ireland's entry into the European Community because he felt it was a betrayal of the nation. Now, I want to make one interesting point there. While he, to some extent, lamented, if you like, that Ireland hadn't turned out the way he had hoped it would be, next to him in the Palace Bar and his great friend was Seamus Murphy, whose life and whose talents were employed as if Ireland had turned out the way it was supposed to be. In other words, he was the embodiment of something native and distinctive. So Seamus was a living refutation, if you like, of Hendrick's cynicism.
Johnny, in the book, was kind of like carted in like Danny Melt, Gargoyle, Blue Skull, Face Mould.
Yeah, I mean,
have them all in the show, do you?
They are indeed, yeah. And I mean, somebody in one of the articles I read talked about them being like characters from a Damon Runyon kind of a world. The names are fantastic in their own right. But one of the things about the flinty integrity that John A. referred to there is that these men are portrayed as having it as well. These are men of considerable substance. You know, they're huge, labouring men, but they have a tremendous sense of their own abilities. They have a tremendous sense of their heritage as well, of a heritage of masonry, which goes way beyond Ireland and goes right out into the European tradition. And these are men who are both utterly rooted in a small yard in Cork and who feel themselves to be connected throughout Europe. There's actually one character in the play called the Gabon, not just in the play but in the book, who is a wandering mason. And his character in the book is so mythical in its kind of scale and in the reverence that's shown to him by the men in the yard that you kind of feel you're looking at a figure who comes straight out of mythology. He is the wandering mason of every folktale you've ever encountered a mason, you know. So I think that there's actually in these characters there's a kind of an epic quality as well. There's no question of them being confined or ignorant or limited. They are actually inheritors of an extremely rich artistic tradition as well as a craft, you know.
And he, at the beginning of Stormad, he gives almost a throwaway definition of art which would apply to these men and which would also apply to himself, in that he integrated in his own work art and craft. What he says is, art grows out of the work of men who enjoy it. And I think he had all the Stonies in mind as well as his own development as well.
He marks the book as well about the duty to make the cornerstone of the cathedral as beautiful as the foundation stone, even though nobody might ever see it.
Yeah, there's a very definite aesthetic running through it, and I think it's an aesthetic that Ken Thompson actually shares. And there's a certain amount of scepticism, I think, about certainly in conversations I've had with Ken about the notion of the artist as currently kind of purveyed, if you like, as a celebrity artist or anything like that. I think that would have been anathema to Seamus. I think it's very much the artist as a natural part of the working world and as a natural part of the community.
John A. Murphy, you did a bust of your once. Were you happy with the likeness, or were you like Archbishop John McQuaid?
Well, of course I was happy with the likeness. It reminds me of how handsome I was 30 years ago. But I don't recall very much the sittings, it seemed to me, because the conversation with Seamus was an ongoing thing. So when I sat for him, it was an intensification of that kind of experience. But again, I was thinking in these recent days that perhaps one of his great sculptors is the tailor, Timothy Buckley, in The Tailor and Nanstey. And there's a hilarious account in Eric Cross's book about sitting for that piece of work and what great fun they had and what scepticism Nanstey displayed about the bush, as she called it. And the last time I saw the tailor, by the way, in his new head, as he called it, was in Farmley House. I forget what they're doing there. But it was great to hear Seamus talking about, say, the bust of people like John Charles McQuaid.
You didn't get that didn't work out so well for him, though.
Well, yes. And maybe that's why he would look at it detachedly and say to you, would you look at him? God, would you look at him? And, you know, as if he had nothing whatsoever to do with the creation of this particular skull. So he was marvellous in that regard.
But you talked earlier on about his anti-clericalism and causing him problems when they were building a spate of new churches in Cork in the 50s. He didn't get one gig out of it. And a couple of friends of his came together and commissioned a piece for Bishop Lucy at the time in the hope that he might persuade him that Seamus Murphy was a great sculptor. But that didn't work out either. Was that going back to his father's position in the church that he was, that he was punished.
I don't think so. I think Lucy, like so many churchmen of his time, Catholic churchmen of his time, Lucy was a learned man in terms of theology and social policy and so on. But he was a complete Philistine, like most of his colleagues, when it came to anything like art or painting or sculpture. After all, as one of the characters says, I think it's the gargoyle in Stone Mad, and of course this is Seamus speaking as well, they were talking about the new building in Turner's Cross, the new church in Turner's Cross, which I think sometime in the 1930s. And even though in architectural terms many people would regard that as a great achievement, you know, and an example, a fine example of Art Nouveau in architecture, for people like the Stoneys, it was a disastrous development. This huge enterprise was essentially to be concrete, or mud, as they called it, you know. And there were agitations, apparently, to make the old bishop call and aware of their concerns and so on, but they came to nothing. And then the gargoyle says, Asha, what would you expect from farmers' sons who never saw anything but the gable ends of cowsheds? And that sums up the whole thing, you know. In other words, Seamus's version of the Twilight could not prevail over the imported, simpering Italian mass-produced Madonnas, and that was about the size of it. When Bishop Lucy was on holidays once on the continent, and a church was being built at that time in Cork, in Dennehy's Cross, he apparently sent home a postcard, a picture postcard of wherever he was in Spain, with a ring around a dome, and with the message to the architect, this is the dome for Dennehy's Cross. So that was about the measure of his aesthetic understanding. So if anything, Seamus was extremely mild, I think, in his reactions. I never heard them being bitter about anything, really. And even when he spoke seemingly disparagingly about someone, you felt that it had a great deal of sympathy for the person himself, you know. Perhaps I'm romanticising his memory now.
Johnny, in the play, what's the ultimate character of Seamus Murphy?
I think he's just extremely benign, quite clear-eyed. There's a lot of openness, and there's a lot of easy conversation, and there's a lot of wit in what he has to say. I mean, quite a lot of the text is actually taken verbatim from the book. The dialogue is so well written, I don't see any point in, you know, trying to improve
it.
On what I think to be excellent in the first place. It's very, very sociable. It's very warm. But I just feel that there's a very strong subtext of a keen, observant intelligence at work under the kind of affable exterior which is presented. And I hope at least that is the overall kind of compound that comes across in the way he's presented.
But of course, being a Cork man, there's a lot of his work in Cork. One time he boasted Johnny Murphy that he'd put the Virgin over the door in the Bon Secours.
He did, yes. He said, 'twas I put the first woman over that door. And that was typical of his mischievousness, you know.
But what piece of sculpture do you see in your everyday passage or travelling
If you lift up... Well, the funny thing is, I'm not all that gone on Michael Collins in Fitzgerald Park. I think it's too heroic and too monumental. You don't get from it anything of the Collins who could swear like a trooper. And it's too idealised, I think, and too monumental and too heroic. But maybe that was the commission, you know. But not far away, and if you lift your eyes, is St Finbar at the top of the eastern wing of UCC.
That was the one that replaced Queen Victoria.
That's right. And according to some people, many people were never bothered by Queen Victoria because they thought she was Our Lady. But at any rate, in the 1930s, just after Seamus came back from Paris, it was a time of very intense Republican activity in college. And the story goes that the students had threatened to blow up Victoria if she wasn't removed, well, democratically and peacefully, as the IRA are now given to saying in their new language. So the college authorities took her down, and she had a different history, but that's another thing, and commissioned Seamus to do, I think, what must have been a very welcome piece of work at that time. And as someone said a while ago, maybe someone quoted the fact that a good artist will work well even where people will never see it. Well, in a way, that's true of St. Finbar. He's depicted unusually for the time, not as the kind of conventional anachronistic bishop, but as a cowled monk, you know, austere, quite an austere depiction. But you have to have binoculars to see it, really. And it's a fine piece of work and should be, like all Seamus's work, I hope that it will be presented over these next few months in one way or another to a new generation.
Johnny, you're of a younger generation. What piece do you gravitate towards as you admire of Murphy's work?
Well, I actually like Michael Collins. It's funny that we should be talking about this particularly. But
why do you like him?
I like the modelling. I like the very strong personality that I think radiates from it. I don't find it in any way reverential, or I think there's a tremendous strength in it, and I think it actually conveys to me maybe what I know already about Collins, or what I think I know already about Collins. So certainly that will be one that I would like. I like the scale of it as well. But in reading the book and in working on the play, I've become intensely aware, actually, of Stone and of the complexity of the building in the city. And I'm sure, I'm not suggesting that it's a Cork thing purely, but by just observation, by talking to Ken Thompson, by reading this, you just get a sense of the immense amount of craftsmanship that you literally just stroll by without glancing at. So there is actually a celebration of just of Stone itself and of a whole tradition here, which I think Seamus Murphy would probably be very well pleased to see beginning.
Well, I'm afraid perhaps that the days of stonework are over, that pouring concrete is making the country filthy rich, and we'll hardly go back to stone now. Anyways, Professor John A. Murphy and Johnny Hanrahan, thank you very much for joining us. Stone Mad continues at the Everyman Theatre until the 21st of April. Having written more than 30 novels, which have collectively sold over 70 million copies worldwide, the writer Wilbur Smith has topped the bestseller list for nearly 5 decades. His latest novel, The Quest, is part of the Egyptian series and follows on from River God, The Seventh Scroll and Warlock. In the novel, Egypt is struck by a series of terrible plagues that have crippled the kingdom, and then the ultimate disaster follows. The Nile fails and the water that nourish and sustain the land dry up. Wilbur Smith joins me now on the line from London. Wilbur, you're very welcome to the 11th Hour.
Thank you very much, Pádraig. Good to be with you.
Well, I'm delighted you're here because I'm a big fan of your work when I was a young fella. I really enjoyed reading your books.
Lovely.
Go back to the start. You were born in Africa, which was then Northern Rhodesia.
That's indeed, yes. It was colonial Africa in those days.
And now that's Zambia now. That's
Zambia.
Tell us about your growing up in Africa, when you left it, or how it influenced you.
Well, my father was a rancher, cattle rancher. And he had some big estates, big ranches down on the Kafue River. And that was the place where I spent my early years. It was wonderful life for a small boy, because the big Kafue River ran through the bottom of the ranch, so that there was fishing and hunting. We had thousands of head of game on the ranch. So I had as my companions all the little black boys and girls whose parents worked for my dad, and it was a perfect existence. And it has played a very, very significant part in my writing, because what I learned then and my memories from that time goes back into my books about Africa.
But in your first of the Courtney series, which is about Africa, when I used to read them, you could smell Africa, you could eat Africa, you could breathe Africa. Amazing detail. You must have been very affected by the landscape around you when you were growing up.
Absolutely. I was totally, it was me. I absorbed everything, the incredible variety of forest and savanna and big rivers and lakes and, of course, the sea lion. And then the wild animals, I've always been fascinated by them. And the people of Africa, the diverse tribes, also different from each other. These have been the grist to the mill of my writing.
So when did this idyllic life break up? When you were sent away to school, or
exactly that dread day, which I looked forward to it at the time. I was sent off to boarding school when I was 10 years of age, and I thought this is going to be another adventure and be great fun and lots of other guys to play with, And it was terrible. I hated school. I longed for the times when I could get back to the ranch and get back to that old life. But it was never the same again after that.
And was school far away from home?
3 days travel by train. So that meant I couldn't come home at half term or, short holidays. I only came home once every 6 months, as it were.
That must have been very difficult, being wrenched away from your family at that early age.
Homesickness is not a very pleasant sensation. And I suppose that's the first time I really took to books as an opiate for that, being locked up in a minor borstal, as I looked upon the school.
Well, a similar experience myself. I was sent away to boarding school at a young age, and I found books. What books did you find? What books did you find interesting at that stage in your life?
Well, I started off with things like Biggles, the Biggles books about the flyer in the Royal Air Force during World War One, and then I moved on to other things like Rider Haggard, C.S. Forrester, and 39 Steps, Green Mantle, all the young man's books or the boys' books.
The adventure reading. He's looking for the wild adventure.
Absolutely.
So what possessed you to turn to writing?
That's a very difficult question, Bordick. I mean, I suppose it's just I had the itch. I just had the desire to it. I loved books. I loved the idea of writing, and I thought, could I join those creatures living up on the heights of Olympus, the authors of this world, which, I looked up to them. I started off with short stories, and I started to sell some of those at a huge sums of money, like 60 quid a time. And then one short story just grew and grew and grew until it became a novel.
And that was When the Lion Feeds.
When the Lion Feeds, yeah.
Which was about two brothers were the essential characters in that novel.
Yes, they were two brothers.
And this seems to be an ongoing theme in your work, is two brothers, the tension between brothers, the rows between brothers, the love brothers have for each other. Did you have a lot of brothers yourself?
No, I'd never had a brother, but I was very interested and intrigued with the family ideas, the family. My dad was a Victorian father, and he was an enormously powerful figurehead in my life. And he was the father in When the Lion Feeds. And the two brothers were, in fact, I suppose now looking at, being clever and analysing it, were myself. The one side of myself that I would like to come to the fore, and the other confused and weaker side of myself. So those were the two brothers in conflict with each other.
In that book, as I was saying earlier on, the colour you bring to writing about Africa and about Rhodesia, as it was at the time, or the continents of Southern Africa, is amazing. But also, you tell a great story. Did that come from sitting around the fire and when you were a child, or listening to your uncles? Or where did you learn this gift of storytelling? And where did you hear stories first?
I learned, first of all, from my grandfather. He was a great raconteur. He told the tallest stories, but the most intriguing ones that any small boy has ever heard. And then from that, I, of course, enjoyed reading. And so I think I developed an air, a sense of timing from the other books that I'd read. But on skills with being able to play the piano, being able to act, being able to hit a cricket ball or a curling ball, all those things, they come from a gift within you, I think. So I think I had the gift of being a storyteller.
But in your culture and when you grew up, books were very important because that was the only entertainment, and storytelling was very important because when the lights went out, you couldn't read books.
Absolutely, that is true. And there was no television. And radio was very, very fluky. Had to rig up a wire to the top of a tall tree and hang a bottle on the end. And then you'd have a crystal set, and the quality wasn't good. It certainly wasn't. And I remember that during the war. We used to listen to BBC every night, and everyone had to shut up because Dad was listening to the radio, and he'd hang over the set and you know, give you a slap around the back of your ear if you just murmured at all. So, yes, books were important. On the ranch where we lived, my mom used to send down to the nearest town, which was 200 miles away, to the library there, and they'd send back a bag of books once a month. Then she'd send the old ones back. So that's why we always had a lot of books to read.
You just talked about the war there. How was your situation during the war? Like, the war did spread to East Africa, and how was the situation in Northern Rhodesia or Zambia at that time?
Well, we were isolated from it. You know, we didn't suffer from rationing or anything like that. The fighting was up in the north, up in the western desert, around Cairo and Tripoli and that area. There was a lot of U-boat activity along the coast, but we never suffered air raids. We had no rationing. I mean, we always had bread and butter and meat on the table. And so we were cut off from it. But, of course, all the eligible men volunteered or were enlisted, and they all went, as we used to say, up north. And they fought against Rommel in the Western Desert. But I was too young to be involved in that. Timing is a good thing in life, you know, Porik. I've been born at the right time. I've never been swept up in a war. And, you know, I was born too late for the Great Depression of the 30s. I didn't have to go up north and get shot at by Germans. So I've been very lucky.
But I suppose life is tremendously exciting when there's a war on, or when there's an adventure on, or when there's, in your books, the life your characters live is life under constant threat of death.
Yes, well, when you're writing sort of adventure fiction, you have to put your characters in harm's way, because really an adventure story is about men struggling to do something or to avoid being done themselves, and the whole plot is how do they get out of it? You know, once peace breaks out all over the book is finished.
You are supposedly, you have invented the genre of adventure fiction. What are the qualities that you try to bring to your books?
First of all, I set my books in Africa, all of them, because I know it well. And then I am able to, as you were kind enough to say earlier on, to give the smell and the feel of Africa to my reader. Then I have the struggle. Every adventure book has that struggle in it. And I'm a romantic, and I believe in good guys and bad guys and the eventual triumph of good over evil. So that's really what it's around. And then you put a, you know, you've got to have the girls in there, because the girls are very, very important. And I found that out very early on in my writing career. So always in my books, they're very, very powerful women, female characters. And, you know, you just dream up the families, the relationships in the family, or why are people in conflict with each other and how those conflicts work out. And that is the adventure story.
You people remark that you write about sex very nicely in your books, and that your love scenes are very beautiful. But your violent, your death scenes are fairly graphic too. Which, you know, I know perhaps you get pleasure from writing the love scenes, but how can you write the shocking chopping of an Achilles tendon and a subsequent skewering through the throat with the short-handed blade? Or a beautiful description, I admit, but did it disturb you to be writing about people getting chopped up in battles and fights?
Well, look at it this way. I am a great lover of women, and, you know, and that's why my love scenes are always so very important in the book, and the love affairs and the relationships between men and women. But the thing that really, at my age now, and I've seen so much, the only thing that really upsets me and hurts me very badly is the inhumanity of man to man and the inhumanity of man towards the animals. So that's why I write about them with such passion. That would explain it, because I have been in situations in Rhodesia when Ian Smith's war was going on there. I was there. I saw some terrible things. And I've had bullets flying around my head and falling on flat on the ground and trying to dig a hole for yourself virtually with your fingernails. I know what fear is. And so these are all the things that I write about in my books.
So as you've experienced passion, you've also experienced violence, and you can write about it.
I think that is correct, yeah.
One more question I got to ask you when we're talking about relationships and writing is, you have a great line in Brothers Falling Out, and we in Ireland have, you say to somebody, I haven't spoken to my brother for 30 years in Ireland, and people say, that's normal. In other societies, that's not normal. Is it normal in Africa not to speak to your brother for 30 years?
Well, if he's a bastard, you don't speak to him, do you?
Why does that interest you? Why does that dynamic interest you?
Because it does happen, and it's the way we are. The siblings, siblings in the nest, and some birds, they kill each other. And I think that there is a tremendous rivalry between brothers and in the family. First of all, the rivalry is for the attention and the approval of your parents. And after that, it's just because if you were smaller, he hammered you, and when you get bigger, you're going to hammer him back. And I think it's healthy, because in nature, of course, it splits them up so that they don't
have to deal with each other every day.
Absolutely right. They're not rivals for each other. They're not in competition. They can devote their energies to other things.
We better have a quick chat about your book, seeing that we're here talking. Your most recent book. This is, as we were saying, your fourth book in the Egyptian series. This is, as you say, going up north to write.
Well, the Egyptian series, people say to me, all your other books are written about Africa. Why about the Egyptian series? I say, well, if you think about it, Egypt is in Africa.
Definitely.
In this book, the protagonist, my main character, who's Taita, the sage, the master of the occult, he moves down from Egypt itself and follows the Nile down into what is now Lake Victoria, the Great Lake systems, the mountains of the moon. And so my characters in the fourth novel are moving deeper into Africa, where all my other works have been set. And this fascinates me because that area, I know it particularly well from when I was a lad. My father had a light aircraft, and we used to fly up all over the mountains of the moon, down the lakes of Victoria and Nyanza, and then down the Nile as far as Khartoum. So, it's revisiting those countries and the fascinating areas that I did when I was a boy.
The basic story of Taita, who's featured in the rest of your books, has to solve the problem of the Nile drying up. This is the book, The Quest, we're talking about here. Is this some sort of metaphor for what's happening in the environment in Africa, the environmental problems that Africa face these days, that the rivers might dry up and that would be the end of civilization as we know it?
I think that was in my mind. And the idea of the plagues of Egypt, that's not entirely original. The Bible got there first. But there's so much that today is echoes of it in history. I've taken other themes in this book. For instance, the idea of human bodies being regenerated by a mixture of witchcraft and science, as I've got in the book, is just straight stem cell cultures of today, where bodies are being rebuilt.
But what I find fascinating about it is how you actually manage to name everything, and name phenomena, name places, name deities, name characters, and then it creates a fascinating tapestry, a rich tapestry. Where do you invent those names, or do you find them in research?
They come from my mind, from for my own imagination, but say the Book of the Dead, for instance, or the Book of the Doors which have been translated from the style from the hieroglyphics. These have got fantastic names in them. You know, the names of the old gods, the names of the pharaohs, the names of the people of that time, and they've got all of them have got an evocative ring. And so, for me, naming of the characters is terribly important because names suggest characters. You know, even today, you think of the name of a woman gives you an idea of the woman itself. That's why so many film stars and that change their names to something that they feel is more attractive and would suit the character that they wish to portray. So naming my characters is a very, very large part of the creation of my books.
Considering you've written 30 novels, and most of your novels have got a lot of characters in them, you must have a million or two characters racing around your head. Do you remember them all?
Well, fortunately, I can go back and do a bit of swatting and remember, because, as you say, I've written so many millions of words in my life that I can't recall them all just immediately. In fact, an amusing thing happened a few years ago when my son had all his friends from university come out to my farm and spend the weekend, and we all had the barbecue and had a few beers together and started chatting, and they'd all read my books within the last couple of months. I hadn't read some of those books for 20 years, and they started questioning me about the characters. And damn it, I couldn't remember who the characters were. By the end of the evening, they were looking at me as if to say, okay, this guy's a ringer, he never wrote those books. So I had to go back and reread them all. And I want to tell you, Porik, that was an interesting exercise, because it was like getting used to it. Time machine and going back to myself in 1964 and then rereading and thinking, my God, why did I write that? And then remembering, and other parts, I'd come to a sequence or a paragraph or two, and I could clearly, just like a boom, in like a TV camera in my mind, I could see the room that I wrote those words in, and I could remember the mood that I was in when I wrote them. So, no, I don't remember them all, but when you went back and read.
But when you went back to read them, would you correct yourself? Would you say, that was really poor there, Wilbur?
Well, I had a lot of that, like, oh boy, did I really write that? How callow, how crass. And other sections, I'd read a section and say, not bad, boy. You got it right that time. So it was a worthwhile exercise.
What would you attribute your popularity too? What's the basics of your young lads who want to be writers and want to be as popular and as successful as you? What would you say to them?
I think the success is that I can create characters that people care about and that people identify with. And so they're not reading about a stranger. They're reading, within a very short time, they're reading about someone which is they would like to be, they'd like to emulate, and they worry and they care about what is going to happen to him or her during the course of the book. So, identity. I'm able to make my reader identify with my characters.
And empathize with them.
That's it.
You do that very, very well, sir. Thank you very, very much to my guest, Wilbur Smith. His latest book, The Quest, is published by Pan Macmillan. From all of us here in the 11th Hour, Ewa.